stranded in Egypt have arrived back in the UK. An EasyJet flight touched down at Gatwick in the last hour. 29 planes had been planned to bring people from Sharm el-Sheikh today, but only 8 will now run. Victoria Bourne reports.
The problem is we've got to get 20 planes on
board. Can we know that? But what is the actual problem?
Some tourists in Sharm took out their frustration on the British ambassador.
Our aim is to get as many people home as soon as possible.
Thousands are waiting for flights, but others are more understanding.
Back in New York, post-Hurricane Sandy, so I kind of know the challenge of getting back in a difficult situation.
Flights were suspended after fears a bomb caused a Russian plane to crash there last weekend.
Meanwhile, Russia has suspended all flights to Egypt until the cause of last weekend's plane crash is known. Thames Valley Police have named a man they want to speak to in connection with the fatal shooting of a woman in Oxfordshire. They're looking for 20-year-old Billy Johnson from Abingdon after Kerry Reeves was shot in the head at close range on Tuesday. Detective Superintendent Chris Ward says the suspect has a tattoo on his hand saying life is precious.
Anybody that's seen him or knows where he is, contact the police immediately. He shouldn't be approached. I'm satisfied that he has access to a firearm and he has previously carried weapons, so he is dangerous.
A man who strangled his half-sister to death while she slept has been jailed for life. Gareth Hindmarsh will serve at least 22 years in prison after admitting the murder of Linda Norcup. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, airliner down over Sinai. Questions this week over whether, as they claim, ISIS brought down the Russian Airbus on Saturday. If so, who helped them? Is this just part of the wider US-Russian conflict in Syria? As Mubarak's old defence chief, Egypt's President Sisi, visits Britain, we ask, why is this dictator being entertained at our expense? Who conducted a coup d'etat against the democratically elected Morsi government? And who's put the party which won those Egyptian elections in jail? Plus, if you're turning up to visit Bristol Cathedral, even if it's just for a quiet prayer on Tuesday morning, you'll be turned away. Not that there's any warning of that on their website. The Merchant Venturers, Bristol's merchants, they financed the Cabot reconnaissance trip to America and the transatlantic slave trade that followed it. Now, well, they just control Bristol's two biggest NHS trusts, several big secondary schools, and help run Bristol Water and most of the other city monopolies. Yes, Bristol's elite merchant venturers have their annual block booking of the cathedral next Tuesday morning, where Bishop Mike will be blessing their nefarious activities before they troop up to Merchants Hall in Clifton for another slap-up banquet. But are their financial decisions bearing fruit for the city and the nation? And how much of their wealth do they intend to share with the rest of us? One of their most fervent prayers next Tuesday morning is that the details of their finances won't be revealed, so they can carry on saying they give back more to the city than they take, and nobody will be any the wiser. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Here it is. The weather forecast escapes me for a moment there, but anyway, tonight lows of 14 degrees Celsius and showers. This weekend, highs of 16 and showers and breezy. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius, cloudy with patchy rain, occasional sunny spells and breezy at times. Next weekend, that's the 14th and 15th of November, highs of 10 Celsius, sunshine and showers with gusty winds next weekend. So temperatures going down quite a lot during this week. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, joining me now from Cotton, Lib Dem councillor Anthony Negus, and welcome to the Politics Show, Anthony.
Thanks, Tony.
First of all, your portfolio on the City Council now. The Lib Dems are down to only, well, far less councillors than they were. I mean, not been doing very well over the last couple of elections. How many of you are there now?
We are nine strong and still fighting way above our weight.
But what's brought about this deep decline in the number of Lib Dems on the City Council? Is it just following the national pattern?
I think the national trend is much to do with it. I think we're well recognised for our work within our wards and our very high profile attempts to bring Bristol into the 21st century with creativity and innovation. And I'm afraid there's not much sign of a great deal of that at the moment.
What about this attempt to get a referendum, another referendum onto whether we're going to have a mayor or not? Because this, we are, I believe, only one of the only cities in the country that's been basically told, well, this is a ratchet system. You get a mayor, you can't go back again.
We're not one of the cities. We are the only city in the country because we're the only city that was foolish enough to take away a democracy from its local council in the last round of mayoral appraisals, which was done in the middle of 2012, and because of that, that particular act has a no return component. So Bristol, literally, now that we've made that vote, which was a very very low turnout, as I'm sure you're aware, we are now stuck with something which we may want to change in the future and might find ourselves unable to.
Yeah, your former boss, now Dame, is it Barbara Jank, up at the House of Lords, has been doing her best to get changes. Is there anything happening?
Well, we're still talking. We had there was a meeting between her and other sympathetic cross-party members of the House of Lords and, in fact, members of the Commons, and that we're hoping is still moving in the right direction.
Fingers crossed. Doesn't sound all that hopeful, Anthony.
Well, I'm afraid once somebody, if someone wants to bring in something which takes away people's right to change things in the future and be flexible and be democratic, company or that organisation, in this case, the Conservative Party, is not going to take that right away easily. We have to fight for it, as we've had to fight for every other right that we've ever gained in this country.
Isn't there another approach to this? Surely a candidate could stand for mayor next year who's quite explicitly going to change the system back to the way it was before. I mean, surely that's within their power as mayor to, shall we say, give some of the powers that they have away.
It's possibly within their in their power as mayor to change some of the way that governance works in this city, but the governance is also written into the act which gives the mayoralty the powers it does. And although the mayor has clearly overemphasised the powers that he's entitled to under the act and is working as far over in that respect as he possibly can, as I understand it, no person elected as mayor in Bristol will have the right to change the process back, because that's national legislation, not under our control, and B, has very little wriggle room in terms of the governance of Bristol City Council, which is also set by that act.
But I mean, what I'm saying is, if that power is invested in the mayor could choose to include other people in that decision making process too, if he wished to. Surely.
Well, the mayor could do that now to a certain extent,
yeah.
And has chosen not to do that, and we're saddled with that. I'm hopeful that whoever the new mayor is going to have a much more democratic view of the way this city is run, and that includes listening to people that don't actually have the same single point of view as the mayor does.
Well, it may not be a new mayor. It may be just George Ferguson all over again. And I noticed
case we're stuffed.
This week in the Bristol Post, yet another advertising, well, we almost call it an advertorial, really, because the Bristol Post does seem to, like, two or three times a week now actually have some kind of almost part of the election campaign to be saying something wonderful about George Ferguson. And if it's not saying something wonderful, it's saying, oh, isn't it dreadful, he went 22 miles an hour in a 20 mile an hour limit. So it's a kind of very soft anti-mayor story. Everyone should have a fair share of Bristol's success, says the Bristol Post this week. As George Ferguson approaches the end of his third year in office, he sets out what he's achieved. And obviously there's a whole list of wonderful achievements. Now, what does it look like from your point of view, Anthony?
If you want me to comment on the sycophantic way that the Bristol Evening Post refers to George Ferguson, then I heartily agree with what you're saying. It's very clear that happens. We, as Liberal Democrats, have tried, and I don't know how about other parties, but we've certainly tried to get articles into the Evening Post which have not been not found their way through the system, let's put it that way. And everything is glitzed and glossed to suit the mayor. My view was that this is, like with so many other public figures, the Evening Post is going to put someone up and then knock them down, but there doesn't seem to be very much sign of that at the moment.
Don't you think this is actually quite an important aspect to democracy in the city, where the local paper shows both sides of an argument? Say, for example, if they get a press release from the Lib Dems or Labour Party or Conservative, they should surely give that equal standing.
But
They do seem to have a very close relationship with George Ferguson. What's that all about?
Well, do you want me to keep agreeing with you? I mean,
where's it coming from?
Yes,
where's it
you're right.
From? Why is it that the Bristol Post seems to be so pro-George?
I seriously don't know. There is a, I mean, your introduction included the Merchant Venturers and the long arm of their involvement in Bristol City Council. George was a Merchant Venturer. I think he's probably now severed his formal links with them. But there is an old school in Bristol, and that old school is very heavily around business and established practices in Bristol. And George is a part of that process, and so is the Bristol Evening Post. I mean, I leave you to make your own... I don't think you do need to make them. I think you've already made your own opinion, and I agree with it.
Yeah, how much power do you think they have, the Merchant Venturers? Because, as I said, it's their annual big celebration next week, next Tuesday. They take over. I didn't realise you could block book the cathedral and shut out everyone else.
I don't think I object to people booking the cathedral. Lots of other people, the universities do, lots of other people do that. I don't think that's necessarily a particular problem. My concern about any organisation is, first of all, I'm very concerned about the concentration of too much power and influence in any one organisation. And as you would obviously expect me to say as a Liberal Democrat, I'm extremely worried about transparency. If people have that amount of control, then we ought to understand exactly where that control is used, how influential it is, and how it can be contested. And it's very, very difficult to get into some of these organisations. It's twere with us. I mean, I fought a lot of long battles in the 1980s against the health trust, the health authorities as they then were, the local health organisations, because they issued no minutes, they were closed door, and just the same with academies. You can't now find out about what's going on in academies. We are seizing up in this country in terms of lots and lots of more and more closed doors. And I'm very concerned about it.
Now, people would, I imagine, point their fingers at you, Anthony, when you were running the city council, say, well, actually, the Liberal Democrats are almost like a little city elite.
I think not. We issued everything. We had lots of consultations around the city. I at least one evening a week, I was out at a local consultation on one of the city-wide issues, not one of my ward matters. And we encourage that. And I would encourage more and more consultation. It's out of a big dialogue. It's out of lots of ideas, and particularly lots of conflicting ideas, that you actually drive out a solution. You certainly don't do that for one person saying I'm right and everybody being too frightened to challenge it.
You think that's the situation we're at now?
You might want to say that. I wouldn't possibly comment.
That's a great quote, isn't it? Well, gosh, what's that? I can't remember the name of the series. It was a TV series.
It
wasn't.
It wasn't.
House of Cards, I believe.
Yeah, quite right.
That quote's from. But you're chair of scrutiny. That's a bit of a big job. What does it involve? I know you're having to keep an eye on quite a lot of stuff. Is it property, planning, that sort of thing, neighbourhoods?
Well, I'm leading my group for property and planning because that's sort of what I used to do when I was cabinet member. But I chair the Neighbourhood Scrutiny Commission, and that at the moment has had quite a few big things come up, like the waste contract, which had happened sort of day one. The libraries, as you could imagine, we've got issues with the parks bylaws, which I think is far from resolved, and there are lots of other issues, including neighbourhood partnerships themselves, which are very high profile. Things like the way we can try and make some money out of some of the services we use by selling them to other people. We're an enormous organisation with some skills and some power, and in that respect, we actually have the ability to be quite a large business, and that's comes partly under my neighbourhood scrutiny commission view as well. So it turned out to be a very lively time.
On the waste pile, I mean, it might sound silly, but there's loads of leaves out there, Anthony, but in our gutters that aren't being cleared out. Now, I don't expect it to be done every day, but they're starting to accumulate. I was wandering up actually around Cottam a couple of days ago, and I thought, well, actually, it doesn't look like there's been any of this street cleaning going on at all.
I actually, by sheer chance, and I'm delighted you've raised that, I actually met the boss of the new waste company today, completely by chance, and she said it's not been done recently before because it isn't within the contract, but we are now clearing out gullies. And she said we do it as we go along, and the next day at this time of the year is just as bad as it was yesterday. But it is being done, and it won't be done throughout the city because the city has issued a notice to residents saying, please, if your gully is blocked, please clear the leaves because it makes sure that we don't get any flooding.
Does that mean they say they don't have to pay their council tax then?
Well, it's not been included with it. No. Look, this is not my control. I can't do anything about this. I'm simply passing it on to your very avid listeners that this is just a little bit of information I've heard just today. So I hope that gives people a little bit more confidence. So basically, leaves are not part of the contract, and we just hope that good citizens will actually try and make and clear the gullies.
Well, we end up with a bit of wind, and after a few weeks, you're going to have a compost heap at the end of the street.
Well, I'm afraid at this time of the year, leaves, wind, and gathering things it sort of happens. You know, and unless you had someone there 24 hours a day with a broom clearing it out, it's not going to solve it.
It's not quite that, Anthony, is it? They have these kind of giant great vacuum cleaner lorries that go down the street once a week or so and just make sure it doesn't get out of hand and people aren't slipping and sliding as they're walking around. Anyway, let's leave that for the time being. It is that time of year.
I can do nothing about that, and I'm sorry.
Okay. The other thing you mentioned there is the bylaws. We discussed that last week here on the Politics Show as well, which is the looming prospect of city council enforcement officers turfing homeless people out of parks who are sleeping in their tents because they've nowhere else to go.
That won't change with the upcoming bylaws as I understand them. There is a turfing out is not the way this is done. I actually have a very real interest in homelessness. I have done for a long time. We have a system in the city whereby we seek to bring everybody into somewhere safe and warm to sleep. A lot of people choose not to do that, and we don't, even though we conduct surveys regularly around a certain part of the city just to give us a guide to what the total figure is, and that figure is rising, and I make no bones of that, it's rising quite seriously. Nevertheless, we don't move those people on.
I mean, Park Row, for example, in that car park, there's a whole load of people, many of them who are heroin addicts, having to sleep in that car park.
I'm aware of that.
So, I mean, where are these people going to go? There just doesn't seem to be the accommodation for them anymore, the hostel places or emergency accommodation.
All right, another bit of news for you then. At Cabinet on Tuesday night, I fulsomely supported an initiative that's been brought to Cabinet, which is a homelessness investment policy. And that's at last the sort of innovation which we, the Liberal Democrats, did when we were running this city, because we're prepared to cross boundaries in normal practice to to try and get things done, and that's what this has done. And I'm very pleased it's actually taken some investment from Bristol City Council. It's working with St Mungo's, which actually has the experience and the wherewithal to do this. It's working with an agency which actually knows how to house people that need support, and it's taking money or working with a social investment fund. It's putting all of that together to buy up, convert and create 80 new apartments or flats for disabled, for homeless people, to try and solve part of the problem that we've got in this city. It's going to be working for 5 years, and hopefully it will be extended after that, and hopefully enlarged as well. It is one innovative way, creative way of trying to solve an increasing and massive problem in the city.
I know you've recently been involved in this Housing Engagement Day. Do you want to just tell us a bit about that?
Well, it's a Housing Inquiry Day.
Inquiry, sorry.
And when I first became chair of Neighbourhoods Scrutiny Commission, before my very first meeting, I went to see the director. And I said, there are a few things that I think we need to be doing this year, and we need to try and set it up that way. And the overwhelming thing that I wanted to look at was our delivery within this city of affordable housing. While I was still the cabinet member responsible for housing, seeing that the housing revenue account was going to change in spring of 2012, a year before we had notice of this, and I actually changed the instructions or changed the modus operandi of the team so that we could deliver 30 large houses in Bristol as quickly as possible, and we could afford that under the new housing revenue account. So they had a year to get ready for the money to be changed, and then when the money came in, we could start. I have to tell you, by the end of this month, 2015, 4.5 years later, we will have finished 10 of those. And that, I think, is a shame in this city. We are meant to be a progressive city. We're meant to have the resources. We certainly had the resources to do that, because that was as many as I could squeeze out of the system. The first council houses that had been built in Bristol for 30 years, and we've only managed 10 in 4.5 years. And I spoke to the director and said, we have got to review how badly we're doing and how we could do better, and to look at best practice elsewhere. And we set up the Housing Inquiry Day, which was actually a month ago, and from that we have speakers from all over the country, lots of different ways, innovative ways and bold ways. That's the important thing. We have got to be bold as well as creative, and ways of using the land resources we have in this city, the expertise we have in this city with planners and surveyors and other people in the property department, and use all of that with the money that, as a local authority, we can pull together. Not easy, absolutely not easy, but others have done it. But we're doing this in the face of massive oppression and a complete change of the way that central government, the Conservatives, now that they've cut the Liberal Democrats loose, they are now reverting to type, and we are ending up with punitive arrangements against poorer people. And I think the Conservatives actually believe that if they can stamp out social housing, they will stamp out where all the poor people live. And in fact, it's the other way round. The poor people have to live in social housing, and that's their only way to get through and have somewhere decent to live. And with the changes in housing benefits, and with the changes in the right to buy, and with the changes in the rents that local authorities are allowed to charge, which completely smashes their business plan and their ability to move forward and build more houses, the Conservatives have cut the legs off the ability of organisations such as Bristol City Council to deliver affordable housing.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I think it's pretty clear that the Conservative vision for housing is that everyone should own their own home, and that the government should not be in any way involved in subsidising, you know, cheap housing, that people should just be able to maybe get a mortgage or whatever and buy a house on the open market.
Well, it's paradoxical because it was Conservative governments in the 1950s that built the most council houses. It wasn't even a Labour governments obviously initiated council house building, but Conservative governments in the 1950s were committed to it. And there was a general consensus across the board that decent housing at a reasonable cost, reasonable rent effectively, was an essential part of a civilised society.
But who's to say what's reasonable? Because surely whatever the market will bear.
Well, no, because the problem with property in general is that they're not making it, you know, that land is not, they're not creating much of it anymore. So we've now got effectively a property bubble building, which gives the illusion of economic growth, and it's all based on zero interest rates, which is in historical terms absolutely unheard of. So in other words, any upward tick in interest rates will cause the whole thing to collapse like a house of cards.
Can I come in on that? Two things. Firstly, when has it ever been right for the market to dictate decency in the way a government and a country operates with its own people? That's the first thing.
Okay, but surely the idea here is that if the house prices start to rise, more people will come into the market as house builders, supplying more, because there's money to be made.
Supply and demand is not working out there. At the moment, I was told that we have, within Bristol, 5,500 unbuilt houses in Bristol which have planning approval, some of which have had renewed planning approval. In other words, it's been more than 5 years since they had planning approval to build them. I was told just yesterday that figure is not 5,500, it's actually 8,000.
Martin, what's causing this? If I was a house builder with permission to build 8,000 or even 10 homes, I'd be building them to sell.
No, you wouldn't.
No?
Because the reason you wouldn't is because on your balance sheet, they're going to be more valuable tomorrow than they are today. Yeah. Because the land will go up in value. And Martin's absolutely right. Land doesn't... We can't build land. But Martin, land is not the problem here. The Conservatives very fondly say that this is all about difficult local authorities and NIMBY people are not allowing planning approvals and all the rest. That is not the logjam. It is in some country areas, but it certainly isn't the logjam in most of the country. The problem in most of the country is finance. And in fact, if you look at the market in Bristol now, there is a very slack turnaround of properties, and the reason for that is that the relationship between the price of houses in Bristol and the salaries in Bristol is such that there is not the headroom to be able to turn houses around.
Hey, Anthony, I've got a great idea. Why doesn't George Osborne allow people to borrow a little bit more than they can really afford to pay on their mortgage? Then they can buy those houses.
Well, I actually, there's a lot of, I'm sorry, Martin, I don't know if
that's
you want
fine.
To cut
go
out.
Carry on,
I can't
you're
see
what
your
I was
face
going to say
from
anyway.
Over here, but there is a lot of controversy about austerity and cuts and all the rest. I actually have to say I believe that when you're in a trillion billion pounds of debt, then you need to do something about it. But if you actually look at clever debt, debt that's actually going to improve things and move things on. After all, Bristol is bursting to grow in terms of its creativity, its energy and all the rest. One of the major things that's stopping it from doing that is the ability of people to find somewhere to live. People aren't going to move into an area to take up a nice job if they find out that they can't afford the housing that's in that area because not enough houses are being built. So that situation, that is where that creative use of forward borrowing, because if you forward borrow against, and this is getting into somewhat socialist country, if you try to forward borrow against the increasing value of the land upon which the property sits, you are actually then in credit. And there are some models, like for example land trusts, community land trusts, which work on a financial model, not necessarily self-built, but work on the financial model of the value of the land, then there, and this is done a lot in the States, then you can actually move forward because you could be confident that you can borrow forward, do it now, and work out the payback while the land upon which you're sitting is increasing in value.
I think part of the problem is essentially political. If you think about the way the political system works under first past the post, there are a number of marginal constituencies, mainly in southern England, where general elections are decided. And the Conservatives are basically juicing the property market in those constituencies, which is basically handing free money to their own supporters. For example, the whole policy of forcing social landlords to sell off their properties to existing tenants is absolutely lunatic in terms of having a plan for solving the problems of homelessness and so on. But of course, politically, it works really well. If you think of places like Nuneaton, which everybody's been talking about, the idea is that homeowners in Nuneaton will be able to get on the property ladder, get their free money, and then they'll vote for the government. And that's what the bottom line actually tends to be. And of course, if you're outside that charm circle in Nuneaton or anywhere else, it doesn't really matter, because you're not going to affect anything anyway. And there isn't a kind of consensus about this, which there ought to be. Because in actual fact, you see, if you have affordable housing for low-income people, that does in fact prevent property bubbles, because people have a choice. I mean, I remember when I was a child, one half of my family lived in council housing and the other half bought their own houses, and it was actually a kind of almost a choice that people could make and what seemed most sensible in the circumstances. That's not the case now, and it's a one-legged policy. Everybody can't buy their own houses. If you're going to have a free market economy with differential wages, a large proportion of the population are never going to be in a position to get a mortgage. They're just not.
That's certainly true, and it's also true to say that if you have several streams and types and opportunities of tenures and buying in the country, you are less likely to have something going red hot in one sector. But nevertheless, we are heading for that now, I suspect. One of the reasons perhaps that some building is not going ahead is because the contractors that are now getting the word back that these are not selling at the other end, because people, as I said earlier, have got the cost and wage ratio is not working very well.
That's amazing, isn't it? The house is not selling. There's so much. It's a massive housing crisis, but people can't afford to buy somewhere. They can't find anywhere in social renting. Martin, does sound to me like we're coming to the top of the bubble.
Well, that's what happens, isn't it? As there's massive capital gains for those who are already in the game.
Well, what causes it?
And
to
of course,
actually,
for people like the Duke of Westminster, who happen to own most of central London, they do very well out of that.
But causes it to go bang eventually?
Well, what eventually causes it to go bang is, like any Ponzi scheme, you've got to have people coming in at the bottom end, yes, and joining in. And of course, eventually they can't, because their wages are insufficient to get on the ladder. And at that point, the whole thing tops off, and then it, you see, it doesn't settle down at that point. The belief is that as if house prices rise too high, then gradually they'll come down in price. But you will know, as a housing person, that that's not the way it works. They go up and then they go down. But of course, people who make money on the upswing, even if the value of their property then goes down, they're still better off than they were at the beginning. But of course, it's excluding a substantial proportion of the population, at least a third, and possibly a half of the population can't play this game.
And this only works if you can keep sustaining the demand. And one of the most successful ways of doing this in the past has been housing associations. I accept that local authorities have not had a very good record recently, although some of them, we heard from the Housing Inquiry, they have done some quite remarkable things, and there's a lot out there that other authorities are not listening to. But in terms of actually getting buildings built, the housing associations were extremely good at this. There are two ways of building affordable housing. One is the social rented sector through council homes, and that has been largely destroyed now, as I said, by the housing benefit changes, the 1% drop in rents, which means that the business plan doesn't work anymore, and also the right to buy. But amazingly, the other one, the successful one with the housing associations, has been destroyed by the right to buy legislation, which has just been upped by the Conservatives. And they're pretty well giving these things away. And the only thing I can see that's coming out of all that is that they are deliberately destroying the source of new housing. And that is going to, Martin may be right, that is going to push this more and more and more into one particular sector, which as soon as that goes wrong will ferment a major problem.
Martin, you forwarded me during the week this article in The Observer by David Graeber. Britain is heading for another 2008 crash. It does annoy me whenever I see the word crash associated with 2008, because it was a bailout to avoid a crash. What a crash happened in 1929, where the stock exchange and the stock markets went plummeted down in a very short space of time. That didn't happen because we bailed out the banks. But what's the substance of this? Do you think there's anything to it? Another crash? I mean, you know, for years on this show you've been saying, oh, it's just round the corner, but maybe you're right here.
Well, obviously I do think I'm right, otherwise I wouldn't say it. I think when you say there wasn't a crash, there wasn't there was a substantial drop in gross national product. It wasn't as substantial as it might have been because of the intervention of the state and propping up the private financial markets.
But it wasn't 1929, was it?
Well, that didn't happen in 1929, and you ended up with 25% unemployment inside the United States of America and a reduction in GNP of about 50%. Now, that didn't happen because what they did is they stepped in and bailed out the private financial markets in complete defiance of their own textbook, by the way. And that, of course, should have been the turning point for everybody when you realise once you've bailed out the private financial system, in other words, the commanding heights of the economy, then free market capitalism is effectively over. And it has been over since 2008.
So what makes you think that what David Graeber is saying in The Guardian
the main point is a quite simple point, and that's why I sent you, because he's making a very simple point. He uses a graph to show it, is that there's an accounting identity between private sector debt and public sector debt. Hmm. So what happens when you have a shock like the 2008 crash is inevitably the public sector debt goes up because private sector debt is being deleveraged. Now, everybody, and you were mentioning earlier, Anthony, that when you get very seriously into debt, you've got to do something about it. That's true.
Yes.
But it's also true that if government debt doesn't increase at that point, then the crash is followed through. So government debt basically is like an airbag which stops you going through the windscreen. And you would expect that to happen because more people are unemployed and claiming benefits, less taxes are coming in. It's what they used to call automatic stabilisers. And in a well-developed welfare state, like in a country like Finland or Sweden, for example, more so than here, these things are deliberately designed to prevent crashes from becoming catastrophic. So having a welfare system with a bit of redistribution built in isn't some optional add-on. It's an essential part of a successful modern economy. And if you haven't got one, the danger is, you see, if we have another crash now, the government won't have any resources to bail out the financial markets a second
time. One of the things he says,
and then we will go through a 1929 meltdown.
One of the things he says in the article is, why does anybody have to be in debt? Why can't everybody just balance the budget? Governments, households, corporation, and everybody else. And he says there's a sort of almost a secret which is kept by economists and not shared with the rest of us, that all money is debt.
Well, exactly, that's the point.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I think we do have a very real risk in this country of getting into very serious private debt. And the private
it's already happening.
Well, it is, but it's quite right that any government needs to keep an eye on debt throughout the system, not just government debt. But nevertheless, debt, as we know from the ways that measures were put in place in the United States to solve the 29 crash, the right sort of investment can actually bring things forward. I'm aware that ultimately it was a world war, very sadly, that resolved that situation. But in the medium term, that was beginning to bear some fruit and was working. The other thing you need to remember is, although this country deployed an airbag, other countries in the world did not do that very efficiently and did go, I mean, 25%, some countries in 2008, 2009, 2010 would have really jumped for joy at 25%.
Yeah.
It's been very, very serious out there. We must be aware that I quite agree. I think that there is, because this country is so dependent on its housing market, it's the way that that cycle, it pervades the whole financial system, the medium and long-term financial system, that as soon as that circle is cut, it goes wrong. And it doesn't happen in lots of places abroad. We have a much greater level of private rented sector abroad, where the money is spread out over a much longer period of time and just keeps turning over. In this country, because we buy the land, we employ the professionals, we put in the planning application, we then build it, and then we sub it out to the mortgagees and all the rest, that little money is all chopped up over lots of periods of time. And if something goes wrong, the system falls over.
Well, look, for systems definitely falling over for our kids, because according to Shelter, anyway, 100,000 children are going to be homeless this Christmas. Thankfully, though, you won't see them on the streets. Councils have a duty to find children that have nowhere to live, somewhere to sleep. Increasingly, though, councils are forced to place more and more homeless families in the most insecure and inappropriate emergency accommodation. Now, this is obviously close to your heart, Anthony.
It is indeed. Yeah, well, I mean, that's why I'm very pleased that that this initiative that I spoke about earlier is coming. But it's only going to it's only going to solve part of the problem at the moment. Hopefully, it can grow and we can do this a cleverer way. But there is a requirement, for a statutory requirement, for homeless children to be rehoused, and we put them in the best accommodation we can. But sometimes I have to say, and it wasn't until 2012, I think, that we were forced to put some families in bed and breakfast. We were able to resolve that within Bristol, but now that the private sector is running very, very hot, the private sector do not want to deal with benefits tenants. No. We have methods whereby we try to persuade them to do that, and we offer a sort of a passport and various other ways of trying to make that work. Nevertheless, we are more and more thrown against trying to put them into other accommodation, and if we have less affordable housing and less social housing, which we have because of right to buy and our inability to fill that gap, because the government have plugged that as well, we can't use the money that we get from right to buy to put back into rebuilding, because if we don't spend all of it, the government takes it away, then we actually don't have any wriggle room.
Let's go to Westminster. These are the guys that are supposed to sort these things out, the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition this week on Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions.
I have a question from Kieran, a veteran of the first Gulf War. His family are set to lose out, and he writes, "It's a worry to the family, this fear and trepidation about whether we're going to be able to get by." And he asks, "Is this how the government treats veterans of the armed services?"
Well, first of all, let me take the case of the serving soldier. First of all, many soldiers, indeed I think all soldiers, will benefit from the £11,000 personal allowance that comes in next year. That means they'll be able to earn more money before they even start paying taxes. Serving soldiers that have children will benefit from the 30 hours of childcare. And of course, serving soldiers and others will be able to see our proposals on tax credits in exactly 3 weeks' time. But what I would say to the serving soldier is that he is now dealing with an opposition party, the leader of which said he couldn't see any use for UK forces anywhere in the world at any time. That serving soldier wouldn't have a job if the Honourable Gentleman ever got anywhere near power.
Yes, Anthony, this tax credits business is going to, it looks like, House of Lords of all people seems to have kicked this into the long grass for a little while, but up to 3 million people, the lowest paid in the country, being affected by this. Is it simply because they don't vote Conservative?
Well, it's one of four so far, and I'm sure there'll be quite a few other measures that the government has reined back on since it's been free of the Liberal Democrats in the coalition that managed to keep some of these things on an even keel. If you want me to say how I feel in principle on this, I do agree that it would be far better if people had jobs that the salaries of which benefited them, and where that is not favouring work, then some system to make sure that could be sustained is fine, because I believe that people should be in work earning good salaries rather than having the tax in a nonsense way adjusted. But that formula doesn't make sense if it depends very much on raising the living wage, because we that there is no guarantee that that will happen. And even if it does happen, those people that have the living wage, the increased living wage, are those that are going to be most losing out most on these changes. So although in principle it sounds pretty good, in practice it really is unlikely to work. And if it does work, it will still be even more unfair than some of the taxes that we have now. And we sought to change that when we were in the coalition.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think the fact that the House of Lords has knocked this back, I think there's been complaints about that, but it wasn't in the Conservative manifesto.
Indeed.
And the Prime Minister, in fact, said he wouldn't cut tax credits. He actually is on the record as saying that.
As did Michael Gove.
Yeah. Now, of course, ultimately, I would argue, as some of the Greens have argued, that you need to have a universal income. And that's in a way, which is paradoxically the kind of thing that Ian Duncan-Smith's talking about with his universal credit. And one of the problems with universal credit, and it's quite a specific problem, is that he's now going to pay, he's insisting that everybody should manage their own budgets and learn how to budget, which is in principle a good idea, but it's led private landlords to say, well, we're not taking people on benefits. And I ran up to this 2 years ago because I was on benefits at the time, and I couldn't find any private landlord who were interested to rent to me.
We had Ian on here who'd been sleeping in his car, and even though he's got thousands of pounds in his bank account, nobody would take him because he was having to claim benefits.
This is specifically to do with universal credit. But anyway, the idea of a universal credit is a good one, provided it is actually universal and therefore not actually calculated on your income. You could move towards a situation where everybody has a basic income and then they work on top of that, which of course then flexibilises the labour market. We've got this poverty traps now where people are worse off going into work. I mean, effectively, I'm working in a school as a helper. I'm really not much better off than I was on benefits because of my rent and council tax and so on. Lots of people are in that position.
Okay, back to Westminster. Police cuts. Well, there's a new story about this too. Commissioners are threatening to sue the government over unjustified budget reforms of police around the country. I mean, I thought that the Conservatives were very pro-police, but clearly not. Anyway, let's go back to Westminster now and a question from Ron Marsden.
Gordon Marsden. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the Prime Minister realise my constituents in Blackpool face a double whammy on police cuts from his spending review, but also from the new Home Office formula, which chops 14%, £25 million off Lancashire's police? So I ask him, with a cross-party letter from Lancashire's MPs, one from my neighbourhood watch group, one from our police commissioners and six others, mostly Tories, and our chief constable, all saying that this process is flawed, how many blue lights must he have before we hit meltdown?
Well, first of all, let me say to him is that the reforms to the police funding formula is a consultation on which no decisions have been taken. Can I, through him, congratulate the Lancashire Police because crime is down in Blackpool by 5% over the Parliament? Funding for Lancashire Police is £180 million, which is the same in cash terms as 2003. And I record to him that Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary, and I quote, found that Lancashire Constabulary is exceptionally well prepared to face its future financial requirements. That's the view of HMIC. And in a world, in a country where crime, however you measure it, has fallen significantly since this government took office.
Well, one of the reasons it might have fallen is because of the massive fall in the numbers of police officers actually there to record the crime. But Martin, maybe take you first on this. It does look like the Conservatives are really cutting back massively. And I mean, I think it was 2,000 fewer police here in Avon and Somerset. I'm not absolutely sure about the figures over the last 5-6 years, maybe 300-400. I'm not sure. But anyway, we had a massive fall here. And is this justified?
Well, if Kevin Phillips was here, who's the elected head of the Avon and Somerset Police Federation, he would definitely say not. I mean, what's happened is that professionals, whether they're police officers, doctors, teachers, they feel that the government doesn't listen to their concerns about professional standards. And the idea that you can carry on cutting everything forever... I think what will happen is, in actual fact, as happened last time, George Osborne will not bring the deficit down in the timescale in which he imagines he's going to bring it down. It will creep. And that was quite positive. I mean, if you remember, when the coalition came to power, they said they were going to reduce the deficit to zero in one parliament, and they managed to get about half of it down, which is pretty much what Ed Balls was saying in the first place. But of course, the real problem is what we were talking about earlier. If there is a global crash, not just a housing crash in Britain, then it's all bets off, isn't it?
Anthony?
Well, it's always very interesting to hear what Ed Balls says about anything, because he was the prime mover of the problems in the first place with overspending and letting spending get out of control. Mm,
no,
so,
I don't agree with that.
And he may have been proved right in terms of how successful it was in trying to resolve the problem he caused. But I might give him credit on that one. But certainly, we shouldn't have been where we were in the first place. It is proving very difficult to do this. I believe that I served on the police authority for the first year that I was a councillor, and my view was that there was quite a lot of complacency there as to the way it had always worked and the way that it should work in the future. I share Martin's concerns that you can't keep cutting forever. I think some of the cutting has been quite instrumental in making sure the police forces work more cooperatively and probably get some of their management and back office stuff right. What mystifies me completely is why, when all the numbers are going down, the crime rate's going down too. And I don't share your feeling, Tony, that this is because there aren't enough police officers to record it. This recording is being done. In some cases, the way of recording it is changing, but nevertheless, it's still going down. The one thing that really concerns me is the one intractable crime that does not seem to be going down is crimes against women, and that concerns me a great deal. Where everything else is going down, that's rising.
What about fraud and bankster crime? Surely that's rising too.
Well,
being allowed to get away with it is a sort of encouragement to go on and do some more, isn't it?
It still fits within the overall figures that the police prepare, and every time there is a new type of crime, which then has to slightly change the figures. But the broad pattern is still showing a decrease in crime.
Well, and you were someone who was on the old police authority. Hmm. What do you make of this debacle that's been over the last? Well, it's nearly 18 months with the chief constable Nick Gargan being sanctioned, removed, and now even though. A judge said he should be given his job back, he's been forced out by the Police and Crime Commissioner.
I honestly don't feel, I mean, that was 5.5 years ago, I honestly don't feel close enough to the ins and outs and the headlines and all of the nods and winks and all the rest that's going on to be able to make a helpful comment on that. I am concerned that something is not straightforward in terms of a clear-cut case of somebody having their job closed down because of certain misdemeanours. I'm not even sure that, well, I'm actually fairly sure, I don't believe that the Police and Crime Commissioner should be in the position of doing that sort of thing anyway. I think that the way that the PCCs are working and the massive indifference that people have to the PCCs shows that it was probably an unwelcome intervention into the way the police worked. But I still think the police it was right for the police to be challenged over the way that their finances were spent. But maybe we are getting to the point now where there's hardly any more pips left to squeak.
You could be right. I mean, it seems that quite a lot of what government does nowadays is almost like the role of official receiver. Now we've got to sort of sell off this bit, that bit, which we're going to sell off first.
It's certainly happening in other spheres as well. That's I think the government have that responsibility, and in setting up the independent ways of assessing some of these things, I think that they've had a little bit more credibility as to the way that can be done. It's no longer such a governmental thing in some respects as it used to be. They have to be based on figures which are independently assessed.
Yeah, Martin, can I just ask you about this question? I mean, it does seem that when we elect a government, most of what they seem to be doing is cutting here, cutting there, and slowly but surely paring down the size of government, selling off our assets.
Well, if you look at what's happened in Greece, where the electorate voted for a renegotiation of their debt burden and all the rest of it, which have largely, again, private sector debt transferred to the public sector. And we're coming back to your point about Ed Balls. Ed Balls' main problem was that we didn't do enough to re-regulate the City of London or change things in council housing and so on. They didn't follow their own traditional policies. And, of course, Ed Balls was not responsible for the collapse of Lehman Brothers. And the big increase in debt in Britain came about through the bailing out of the City of London. Now, the textbook says you shouldn't bail them out. But I don't recall any of the mainstream politicians of any of the parties saying that we shouldn't have bailed out RBS and HBOS and all the rest of it, because the consequence of not bailing them out would have been have a 1929 crash.
No, but one of the
which
ways
then, of course, changes the whole way we talk about this.
I don't disagree with that, but once you take one proper way, like Lehman Brothers, if you haven't got a system that's fit for purpose, and the Labour Party were warned many times, but particularly by Vince Cable,
yeah,
that we needed to have a much more robust system in place. They completely ignored that, and when one of the planks was taken away, of course the system
fell. Well, they did a devil's bargain whereby the City of London was allowed to get away with doing whatever they wanted, provided they paid taxes into the bucket, which could then be redistributed in terms of things like
one of the ways. One of the ways that we prepare ourselves as a society for these kind of toxic shocks like the Lehman Brothers collapse is through a healthy media that warns us of those things. One of the biggest media at the moment, there are plans to sell it off. That's Channel 4. So here's back to Westminster to hear John Nicholson ask a question of the Prime Minister about that.
John Nicholson.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On the 9th of September, the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport said to the DCMS Select Committee, and I quote, "There are no plans to sell Channel 4. Can the Prime Minister confirm that remains the government's position, that no discussions are underway to privatise and thus imperil this much-loved and important public institution?
Well, first of all, let me say I'm a huge fan of Channel 4, and Channel 4 was a great Conservative innovation. I think it was a combination of Willie Whitelaw and Margaret Thatcher that helped to bring Channel 4 to our screens, and I'm a huge fan. I want to make sure that Channel 4 has a strong and secure future, and I think it's right to look at all of the options, including to see whether private investment into Channel 4 could help safeguard it for the future. Let's have a look at all the options. Let's not close our minds like some on the opposition front bench who think that you know, private is bad and public is good. Let's have a proper look at how we can make sure this great channel goes on being great for many years to come.
Almost sounds like he's talking about you there, Martin, saying private is bad and public is good.
Well, hardly. I've got the opposite view, I suppose. Well, I don't want to see Channel 4 privatised. Of course I don't. I think we've got a very narrow series of views put in the mainstream media anyway. So, for example, when we're talking about the economy there, the discussion we've just had, you hardly hear that in the mainstream. The discussion of deficit denial and all the rest of it. People don't understand the basics about how the economy works because the media don't inform them about it. I mean, we don't need more narrowing of that media experience. I've just been reading this week about how Rupert Murdoch has just bought National Geographic in the United States of America, and he sacked most of the key staff as one of his first manoeuvres. That's the future.
Or maybe Rupert should take over Channel 4.
Well, he might well do.
I have a very pragmatic view about the public-private thing. In fact, I had a conversation about this morning as well, about the Bristol Waste Company, which has come back into the council. But I am concerned that it won't be tested properly unless it can actually be set up against a private tenderer, if you like, to prove that how well it is working. Because just putting something into the public sector doesn't necessarily guarantee it's going to drive out all the things you want to get out of that. It needs to be tested. So I will look at everything on its merits. But I think with Martin, I err on the side of extreme caution about the media. I believe that the media is very stitched up. It's particularly right wing or right of centre in this country and has been for a very long time, and I'm worried about that.
Okay, thanks. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. He gets everywhere, doesn't he? Thanks to this week's guest, Lib Dem Councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus. After the Murdoch News, airliner down over Sinai questions this week about whether, as they claim, ISIS brought down the Russian Airbus last Saturday. If so, who helped them? Is this just part of the wider US-Russian conflict over Syria? Also, Mubarak's old defence chief, Egypt's President Sisi, visits Britain. We ask, why is this dictator being entertained at our expense?
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
And Sky News Radio.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, the first of thousands of British tourists who were stranded